of a consultant and an auditor then for the finished product. So that's why we wanted to present the paper together, because we want to present some results pertaining to Africa. Let me just start with two examples from Africa that made headlines in the press. The one is about Miriam Ibrahim in Sudan, who was sentenced to death for alleged apostasy, that is, leaving Islam, and was sentenced to 100 lashes for alleged adultery. Why? Well, she was brought up as a Christian by her Ethiopian Orthodox mother. Her Sudanese Muslim father left the family when she was 6. She testified that she has been a lifelong Christian. Her marriage certificate classifies her as a Christian, but obviously the judge considered her a Muslim and judged her according to Sudan's penal code, which says you must not leave Islam and a non-Christian must not marry a Muslim. So he found her guilty of apostasy, for which you get the death penalty, and of adultery, for which you get 100 lashes. The lady is 8 months pregnant, so the death penalty will be postponed until she has breastfed her child for 2 years. That's also part of the Sudanese constitution. Just one example, and the other one made the press so many times I can just allege to it. In Nigeria, in the night of 14 to 15 April this year, approximately 276 female students were kidnapped from a government secondary school in a primarily Christian town of Chibok in Borno State, Nigeria. And the rationale was, these girls, they shouldn't go to school. If they get any training, they should go to Quran school, and that's why we are right in making them slaves, sex slaves, selling them off, because they shouldn't go to school in the first place and receive a Western education. These are just two examples that made the headlines in Africa. Now, I had meant to show you a nice map where the countries are highlighted where religious freedom is infringed and where there's persecution. I'll skip that. A quick outline of my paper. I want to clarify a bit the theoretical and methodological framework, and because we're so short of time, instead of dealing with all 5 countries that we are using as examples for the paper, let me just focus on Sudan and use that to explain a bit more about the dynamics and concepts. And then we'll see whether we have a brief survey of the others or not. So what I'm presenting here is based on the research done for the World Watch List that was published in January 2014, and which covers the 50 countries where Christians are persecuted the most. Very quickly on definitions, religious freedom I understand in the way that the UN Declaration of Human Rights does. Persecution in the context of the World Watch List is defined as any hostility experienced as a result of one's identification with Christ. And this can include hostile attitudes, words and actions towards Christians. So a very narrow and theological definition of persecution. If you're interested in a much broader sociological definition, at the book table that I have over there, there's a book by Charles Thiessen about re-examining persecution, and which defines that much more broadly. And a Christian is defined as anyone who self-identifies as a Christian and or someone belonging to a Christian community as defined by the Church's historic creeds. Now, persecution is a very complex reality, and not everywhere where Christians are suffering and having difficulties, they're being persecuted. It might just be that they share with the rest of the population in suffering from difficult circumstances. Just living in a chaotic world creates substantial amounts of suffering for Christians. But Christians might be exposed to double vulnerability in such contexts. Thank you very much.
Side.
Okay, here you see some snippets of the World Watch list, the top 17, then the big gap, and then the last few, and the four countries I wanted to deal with are highlighted there, namely Sudan, Nigeria, Ethiopia, Kenya, and Niger. We were busy talking about the concept. Alright, so brokenness of the world can mean a lot of different things. We are focusing specifically on persecution, and not every suffering of Christians is persecution. I want to quickly explain the concept of spheres of life, and for philosophical underpinning you could go to Doyebert, if I pronounce the name correctly. Circles, expanding circles, the first one, number one there would be private life, that would be in legal terms the forum internum. Question is, how free has a Christian been to relate to God one-on-one in his or her own space? The second one is family life, that pertains to the nuclear or extended family. The third one is community life, so the Christian in his local setting and community. The fourth one is national life. So the guiding question there is, how free have Christians been individually or collectively to live their Christian convictions beyond their local community? And how much pressure has the legal system put on Christians? And how much pressure have agents of beyond local national life put on Christians by acts of misinformation, discrimination, harassment, or other forms of persecution? So ever expanding circles. And then number five below, that is the sphere of church life. And in the questionnaire for the World Watch List, on each of those spheres, there are between 10 and 20 questions asked, just to not overemphasize any one aspect. And then we've got the phenomenon that violence actually cuts across all those spheres. And the importance in differentiation is that if you only focus on press headlines, you usually catch incidents of violence, but you don't catch the pressure that is created by suffocating laws or policies, etc. And that's why you have to look at pressure and violence simultaneously. All right, now to Sudan. You know where Sudan is. Legal protection of religious freedom in Sudan sounds great. There is an interim national constitution of 2005. It, in the Bill of Rights, contains Article 38, entitled Freedom of Creed and Worship. It reads, every person shall have the right to the freedom of religious creed and worship, and to declare his, her religion or creed and manifest the same by way of worship, education, practice, or performance of rites or ceremonies, subject to the requirements of law and public order. So there's a condition. No person shall be coerced to adopt such faith that he, she does not believe in, nor to practice rites or services to which she does not, he, she does not voluntarily consent. Now the subject to the requirements of law in Arabic might read Sharia. And in the case I quoted in the beginning, everything is subject to Sharia. And the issue is that Sharia is applied to a Christian lady who claims not to be a Muslim, but a Christian. And now the appeal will go the route saying the Constitution says she cannot be coerced to such faith that she does not want to adopt. But, so while the Constitution sounds great, practice then looks quite different. If you look at the de facto religious freedom situation for anyone, and you can look at the research document by the Pew Research Center, January 2014, has a title, Religious Hostilities Reach 6-Year High. Quotes from that were presented at the opening session. You will find Sudan scores very high on the scale of government restrictions of religion, and it scores very high on social restrictions of religion. Okay. Now back to the results of the World Watch List. And I'll try to explain some general concepts. Sorry, some graphics went amiss. There's supposed to be a circle around there. Let me try to explain it. We distinguish between a whole number of different driving forces, or those friends chose to call them persecution engines, which drive persecution. And there is ecclesiastical arrogance, tribal antagonism, Islamic extremism, and all sorts of others, aggressive secularism, you can read them. And now they can actually be grouped into three different impulses. The one is the tribal impulse, saying only my group is right. There's the secular impulse, meaning there's no space for religion in the public sphere. It should actually be the secularist impulse. And then there's the exploitative impulse, you are in my way to power or greed or gain. And it's either one of those three impulses that drives toward exclusive power there in the center. Now, which are the persecution engines in Sudan? We identified two, namely Islamic extremism, and secondly, totalitarian paranoia. Let me briefly say something about that. As you know, an overwhelming majority of the population in Sudan is Muslim, mostly Sunni. Sharia law is the foundation of Sudan's legal system. Sudan's elite seemingly aims to enforce an Islamic regime in Sudan. Moreover, apostasy is criminalized, punishable by the death penalty. Blasphemy laws are used countrywide to persecute and prosecute Christians, particularly Christian converts from Muslim background. Now, what about the driving force of totalitarian paranoia? The Sudanese government faces a crisis of existence as a result of the secession of South Sudan in 2011. All revenues went down. The Darfur crisis has continued, as did other internal conflicts, etc., etc. So the government is using inflammatory language against the West to strengthen its support in the population. And because Sudanese Christians are somehow identified with the West, even though there was ancient Christianity from the first century in Nubian kingdoms, there is an effect on Sudanese Christians because they're associated with the West. And how do those two persecution engines relate? It's reported that the line between Islamic extremism and totalitarian paranoia is a thin one. It said that those leading the regime are mainly radical Islamists, and the ruling National Congress Party therefore a means to further an Islamic agenda. This would imply that the role of the government in the persecution of Christians is not primarily driven by totalitarian tendencies, but by radical Islamist sympathies. Okay, then who are the Christians in Sudan? When you say Christians are persecuted somewhere, you always have to say which group of Christians in that country. The World Watch List distinguishes four different groups, and the order is not a value judgment. So there are expatriate Christians or migrant Christians, there are historical Christian communities, communities of converts to Christianity from the main population that now becomes persecuting. And then, and you see it's a very pragmatic classification in order to not to have too many. A particular group that is highlighted there are the non-traditional Protestant Christian communities. That is because they stick out their neck too often and then they get a beating. So in Sudan, you have all four of these groups, but the expatriates have been asked to leave the country in 2013, so there are very few left. You've got the Coptic Orthodox that came from Egypt. You've got about 200,000 of them. You've got various non-traditional Protestant denominations with 100,000. And those who experience most pressure are Christians from Muslim background, because it's not just on the national level or in church life, but it's also the community, the family that persecutes them, and they feel it in private life. This is how the different spheres get different ratings, and you see family life there is higher because of the phenomenon I just mentioned, and you see that actually violent incidents are less frequent than the aspects of pressure. This is a way to show a pattern in a country, and then you can compare different countries, and in different settings those diagrams look quite different. Just that you see forms of violence, there's a whole list of questions, and the main question obviously is how many Christians have been killed in a country in that time frame of the year, and you can browse all those other aspects of violence that are asked about. I'll skip this. And the future outlook for Sudan doesn't look so great. This is President al-Bashir. There's fear that the situation is worsening. And actually interest has gone away from Sudan, which international interest, and that might be mean Christians will be even more increasingly vulnerable. Just as a quick browse on those other countries, I checked all the constitutions of the various countries and they all look great. There's even separation of church and state in most of those countries, but then when you look at real life scenario, these are the persecution engines that you can see. So the most common in those countries that we surveyed is Islamic extremism and also tribal antagonism. In the case of Ethiopia, you've got ecclesiastical arrogance in addition. In Kenya, you've got aggressive secularism. You also have totalitarian paranoia, and often all those also breed organized corruption. And here I stop.
Christoph, thank you very much. We will limit the questions, but let's have a question. If you can just raise your voice, we've just got one speaker.
Yeah,
thank you.
Okay. I do thank you for your presentation. I think just two things. One is that, well, it's, one would like to have had someone from Sudan here to perhaps reflect more specifically as an insider whether Muslim or Christian, just to give a different dimension, because there is that dimension. Secondly, the issue of religion and media. Media also sort of portrays circumstances, because when you look at your map, most of the areas of the conflict, so to speak, Christian and Muslims seem to be within the Muslim heartland. And so the question is, what extent or at what point does one basically, or rather, to what extent do those societies sort of deal with the issue specifically, other than maybe how outsiders view it? Because internally, there seem to be a different dynamic operating too, whether you look at the villages, whether you look at the cities. You find that Christian Muslims, for example, in Iskandaria, in Cairo, basically they have a relationship. Unfortunately, there are Muslim extremists. I don't like the term Islamic extremists because I have a conversation. But there are that dynamic that operate. But yes, I agree that there are some Muslim extremists that need to be curbed and reined in. But of course, it's only a problem for the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mohammed. The perspective of this is an internal perspective of the countries. The people who respond to the questionnaires that are processed are residents in those countries, bringing an internal perspective. And yes, often there is peaceful living together in many contexts. Now the purpose of this instrument is to discover all the other incidents and circumstances. And you've seen the list, and a number just boils it down to one focal point. For each country, there is a country profile with a long narrative giving the various details, trying to differentiate. And I hope you've seen in my presentation the attempt to differentiate as much as possible. So please apologize the time constraints.